Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we explore the science fiction field from all the angles you can imagine. Well, the past, the present, and the future, at least. We're your hosts. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And today, we're going to be talking Star Trek and looking at the Bibles for a couple of Star Trek shows. And later on, we have a quiz that will tax your language skills. But first, Star Trek Bibles. Colin, what brought us to this topic?
I came across the Star Trek Bible, I think, via Twitter, and I had never seen such a thing before. I knew that they existed, but I had never read the Bible for a series. And I know you're a big Star Trek fan, and so I sent it to you. Being a big Star Trek fan, had already seen it.
And I sent you some others.
Yeah, four more.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. So we can't cover all of it, but we'll have a go at some of it. Just in case there's anyone who doesn't know what the hell we're talking about when we say a Bible for Star Trek. And this is something I teach because I teach screenwriting. And one of my classes is about Bibles and creating them. So what a Bible is, for anyone who doesn't know, it's a kind of a foundational document for a TV series, which establishes who the characters are, what the locations are, what the types of storytelling will be for that TV show, and anything else that's important for a writer or a director to know. And as far as I can make out, Bibles have been around since at least the 1950s, probably earlier, and they possibly existed in radio before they existed in television. And of course, they're called the Bible because if you're, let's say, a new person working on a show, and you need to know what is the official truth about something, well, rather than bothering somebody else in the production, you go and look in the Bible. So it's the authoritative explanation of a show. Within that, there are then two types of Bible. There's a pitch Bible, which is what you write if you're creating a series from scratch and you're trying to sell it to people. And then there's a day-to-day production Bible, which is what you use once a show is running and you need to bring everybody up to the same level in terms of understanding the show. Now, I've seen lots of Bibles because, as I say, I teach this stuff. But Colin, you said this is the first Bible you'd seen. So what did you make of it?
Well, I started with the Star Trek, the original series Bible. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I tend to do is I kind of default to comparing a written work to a work that I know in media in some way. Mm-hmm. So I started comparing what it was versus what I knew from watching the series.
Okay.
For example, Sulu was described as having a hobby of the week, and that never showed up. And, you know, based on what you just said, it makes me wonder whether or not these Bibles tend to be living things. Is this a version of the Bible that started off one way? And as they actually made episodes of the show, if they have to update the Bible to keep track of that, or if, you know, for the 60s and the 70s, everything was pretty much episode of the week. There was no truth that really carried from week one to week two to week three or year one to year two.
Yeah. To answer a couple of your questions there, are these living documents that evolve over time? And the answer is usually yes. And certainly in the case of Star Trek, definitely yes. The version of the Bible that we specifically looked at for today's show is dated April 1967. So that's the version that was prepared for the second season of the original series of Star Trek. And there is a book called The Making of Star Trek by Stephen E. Whitfield and Gene Roddenberry, which was published while Star Trek was still on the air. And in there is an earlier Bible, which is the pitch Bible, when Roddenberry was trying to sell the series. And so the characters are not even the characters that we know. So in this early one, for instance, do you know what the original captain was going to be?
Boy, since you're asking me, I'm going to guess it isn't Kirk and might have been Pike.
Not even that. Robert T. April. Note the T in there, which comes back with James T. Kirk later on. So yeah, a different captain to any that we really know, although there have been references to a Robert April subsequently in Star Trek. I'm just looking through at the other characters. Number One, which is the second in command. Now, Number One has been brought to life in Star Trek Strange New Worlds. We've got a Jose Tyler, he's the navigator, a Mr. Spock, who is described as having a red-hued satanic look and surprisingly gentle manners. And then there's the ship's doctor, Philip Bones Boyce, MD. So mostly a different set of characters for this original pitch of Star Trek. But then in the version that we've been looking at, which is from 67, obviously the show's been running for an entire year. So all of the characters now are quite well defined. And so we don't see the same kind of information as we would have had in that original pitch Bible. What did you think of the characters as defined in that Bible?
Aside from little niggling things, fairly accurate to what I remember from watching the series. Even when it first, I was watching on syndication in the 70s, I was picking up niggles, like I said, so Sulu's hobby of the week never showed up. Nurse Chapel's infatuation or crush on Spock was not mentioned, which ends up being a factor in a couple of episodes.
Yeah.
Uhura is the only person, man or woman or alien, mentioned as attractive. And I thought, oh, this must just be a product of its time. And then I read the Bibles for the other Star Trek series, and they're really not. Yeah, women are attractive or curvy or sensual, and men are, rugged and handsome.
Yeah, nothing's changed really, has it?
No. I love the fact that the script starts with that little mini quiz.
Oh, yes. Shall we talk through that?
Yeah, so there's a title page, there's a table of contents. It's 34 pages long. It's not a small document. The quiz I'm mentioning is one question, one page, and it says, can you find the major Star Trek error in the following teaser from a story outline? The scene is the bridge of the USS United spaceship, which blew me away, Enterprise. Captain Kirk is at his command position, his lovely but highly efficient female yeoman at his side. Suddenly, and without provocation, our starship is attacked by an alien space vessel. We try to warn the alien vessel off, but it ignores us and begins loosening bolts of photon energy plasma at us. The alien vessel's attack begins to weaken our deflectors. Mr. Spock reports to Captain Kirk that the next enemy bolt will probably break through and destroy the Enterprise. At this moment, we look up to see that final energy plasma bolt heading for us. There may be only 4 or 5 seconds of life left. Kirk puts his arms about his lovely yeoman, comforting and embracing her as they wait for what seems certain death.
End teaser.
End teaser.
And then it gives 4 possibilities of what's wrong with that scene. The first possibility is inaccurate terminology. Second one, scientifically incorrect. Third one, unbelievable. And the fourth one, concept weak. So you're supposed to tick one of those, and that will tell you whether you're good at judging a Star Trek story. And then it says, no, we're not joking. The preceding page was a very real and important test of your approach to science fiction. So the correct answer is what?
Unbelievable. Captain Kirk would not hug a yeoman on the bridge of the Enterprise.
The reason being?
Well, there are 2 reasons. There's the reason that I thought, and there's the reason they supply. Captain Kirk, famously, and I'm looking at this back through the eyes of 40 years of viewing, and even the eyes of, 7 or 8 year old me, knew that Captain Kirk loved the Enterprise more than anything.
Yes.
Maybe, I mean, his friends were important, but the Enterprise, the lovely lady in the night that was mentioned in an episode.
Yeah.
This Bible, though, has a slightly different reason. It says, why is this the correct answer? Simply because we've learned during a full season of making visual science fiction that believability of characters, their actions and reactions, is our greatest need and is the most important angle. They were encouraging people, I don't want to be blunt, but not to only write great science fiction, but to write great stories. And stories tend to transcend their setting. So if you would not believe this on the setting of a modern day battleship or an army command tent or whatever, then it won't work in science fiction either.
Yes. One of the claims that was made for Star Trek originally was that this was the first science fiction TV series. It's not completely true, but in terms of American network TV peak viewing time of a show not made for children, then yes, it sort of was one of the first science fiction shows. So it was very important for Roddenberry to have everything being taken seriously and for this not to be capable of being seen as a kiddie show or as a joke. And what it says at the end there, try it in your mind as a scene in Gunsmoke, Naked City, or some similar show. Would you believe the people and the scene if it happened there? So I think that's a very good point. I noticed in the bit that you read out, Colin, that it says something about we've learned from a year of making the show that this is the way the stories need to work. So there's a little bit of evidence that this document has been revised for season two.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't pick up on that on my first reading. In our world today, 2022, every television series, every movie, every stream series is intimately connected with the internet and social media and getting feedback from people continuously.
Yes.
And that's maybe a very good or maybe bad thing. In 1967, that wasn't the case. The majority of feedback must have come from letters being written to the studios.
Mm-hmm.
And so there would be days to weeks or months between the time an episode was made and feedback from the audience came. They talk about doing this for a year. And that's not a year of just putting things out there and looking at ratings. They're also looking at, actually, did they have ratings in the 60s?
They must have
had ratings.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
So, that's a year of, you know, ratings feedback and then audience feedback.
Yes. There's a little bit in the Bible which also gives seven rules. The first one starts with build your episode on an action-adventure framework. Second one, tell your story about people, not about science and gadgetry. Number three begins, keep in mind that science fiction is not a separate field of literature with rules of its own, but indeed needs the same ingredients as any story. Number four begins with, then with that firm foundation established, interweave any statement to be made about man, society, and so on. Number five, remember always that Star Trek is never fantasy. There are a couple of episodes which I think are fantasy, but we'll let them have that. Number six, don't try to tell a story about whole civilizations. And number seven, stop worrying about not being a scientist. And I think most of those would apply to all of science fiction or all of drama. So it's a good set of foundational rules.
Yeah, it surprised me, particularly the rule number two. Science fiction was originally going to be called scientification back in the 20s and 30s. And over the intervening 40 years, it has evolved from, I'm going to say, geeking out about the science in science fiction into saying it's science-influenced fiction.
Yeah, there's a section that talks about the USS Enterprise. And then there's, I think you get about a page on the major characters, don't you? A page on each character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were all very familiar.
So there was a bit in there about Spock. Yeah, the final paragraph about Mr. Spock says, we now realize that Spock is capable of feeling emotion, but he denies this at every opportunity. On his own planet, to show emotion is considered the grossest of sins. He makes every effort to hide what he considers the weakness of his half-human heredity. Now, that one paragraph, you could say that there's about 50 years of Star Trek built on that, just on that one paragraph, you know, because Spock became the character in the TV series, certainly became the focus of the films when the original series cast went into movies, because you have one movie where Spock dies, another one where he's resurrected, another one where he talks to the whales, you know. And then much of modern Star Trek is still based around that. You've got Strange New Worlds, which has Spock as a central character, but before that we had Discovery, where it turned out that Michael Burnham had a little-known brother. They've really milked that one paragraph of the Bible to death. But what interested me about that paragraph is that it says, we now realise that Spock is capable of feeling emotion. Because originally, he wasn't capable of feeling emotion. At the beginning of season one, he was emotionless. And it was only through the writing of some very good writers, such as Dorothy Fontana, that we saw that Spock could have emotions.
One other part of this Bible that I was particularly stricken by, on page 30 and 31, it says, what have been the big problem areas in past story and script submissions? Which I think is great advice to pass on and to remember as you're developing this series on and on. It's like, what have we tried and didn't work? And what things do we not even want to like stick our feet into?
Yeah.
The number one was lack of believability. It's, I just cannot believe that these characters would do these things in these situations.
Yeah.
It mentioned intellectual instead of emotional or physical problems, because like the script says, we are an action drama series set in a science fiction world. If you lose the action drama part, you've stepped away from what the series is supposed to do.
Yeah, and it talks about the characters in a bad script sitting and talking rather than feeling or moving.
Yeah, it's not a Chekhov play.
And speaking of Chekhov, I noticed he's not in this Bible.
Yeah.
Do you notice that? Because the Chekhov character, in case anyone thinks I missed what Colin said just now, I know Colin was talking about Chekhov the playwright. I know that. But it made me think of Chekhov, the Star Trek character, who was introduced in season two. But he's not in this version of the Bible. Obviously, Chekhov hadn't been thought of, and he was an afterthought even then.
Yeah, imagine how science fiction would have evolved if Chekhov had never been introduced.
Would it have made much difference?
Well, maybe not to the script or the story, but the actor. This was his beginning in science fiction, and then he's continued to act in science fiction all the way through this.
Oh, yeah, nothing against Walter Koenig. I've heard a few interviews with him, and I think he's great fun. But as a character, I don't know that Chekhov really developed very much. The same is true of Sulu, of course, and really Uhura as well. These secondary characters didn't really become real characters until the movies. And even then, they didn't get very much to do compared to the main characters. Is there anything else on that original series Bible that you want to talk about?
Well, despite its commitment to being wagon to the stars in space or a science fiction naval movie, they seem to put quite a bit of fun, not only into the stories, but into their Bible. So the Bible opens with this quiz to help people understand their own biases and preconceptions about what they're bringing into someone else's work. And it ends with a single question. Do you remember what that question is?
Is it something to do with drugs?
It is. It asks, are you people on LSD? And the answer is, we tried but couldn't keep it lit. Because I could imagine this being, you know, shopped around to various script writers and people that, you know, in the industry, and that's what it ends on. I think it says a lot about the culture of the people that were working on the show behind the scenes.
Sure.
You know, they weren't afraid. Maybe try a little drugs or have a little fun or, you know, whatever. Yeah, we tried, but we couldn't keep it lit.
So that's the Bible for the original series. There's something that isn't in that Bible that I specifically want to draw attention to. And that is something that people say Gene Roddenberry believed in. They say that Gene Roddenberry believed that people in the future would be perfect, and therefore there would be no conflict between the Star Trek characters. If you Google that as an idea, you'll find loads of articles on the web that talk about that. And they all state it as if it is a fact about the original Star Trek. And it isn't, because in the original Star Trek Bible, there is nothing at all about the perfectibility of humankind. There is nothing at all in there about not having conflict. And I would say quite the opposite. The entire Bible for the original series gives you all sorts of ways that you can have conflict between a really very well-defined set of characters. So the idea that Roddenberry believed there should be no conflict is a myth when it's applied to the original series. Where it did come in and is not a myth is in relation to Star Trek The Next Generation, and that's specifically because he wanted to move forward from the original series and do something different. So in the TNG Bible, there are some things in there that sort of talk about how Earth is now a paradise. I don't know if he actually says that people are perfect, but he more or less implies that on Earth everything is fine now, there is no conflict, everyone lives in peace and harmony. But that's not to say that everyone in the universe lives in peace and harmony. He was just talking about planet Earth.
Yeah.
Anyway, shall we move on to the TNG Bible?
Let's, yeah. Now, I'm going to assume that you're just as familiar with the different versions of the Next Generation Bible as you are the original series Bibles.
Actually, not so much, no. I think I've seen two different versions, but they've been very, very similar. But this is the only one that I've looked at closely. I think the later ones are almost identical to this, just a few name changes, maybe.
Because it struck me this must be an earlier Bible, because there's no mention of Worf.
I think you're absolutely right. So we've got Jean-Luc Picard, William Riker, Data, Deanna Troi, Tasha Yar, Geordi LaForge, Beverly Crusher, Wesley Crusher, and you're right, there is no Worf. There is a bit in there that mentioned that the Klingons have now joined the Federation.
Yeah. The other thing I picked up on, and just because that's something I'll be talking about a little bit later in this episode, the original series Bible, this is text. Mm-hmm. Those are not scanned pages. This is actual text. This right. Bible from the Next Generation is a set of scanned pages. You can't yes. search it. It's not indexable.
Right.
Because my first instinct was, to, you know, just, can I find Worf in here? And the answer is you can't find anything in here because it's only scanned.
Yeah. You mean you had to read the entire document? How terrible.
I know.
There's a little bit at the beginning of the TNG one that talks about the ship's mission. And I know there's something similar in the original series Bible as well. Ship's mission, to expand the body of human knowledge, to provide assistance as required to Earth Federation colonies, commerce and travellers, to provide for Earth Federation security, to seek out new life, new civilizations, to provide further understanding of the universe and humanity's place in it. Who are we? And that kind of thing. So it does have a mission, but it's fairly vague, and it means that TNG was open once again to almost any kind of story, because the ship could go to any planet and find some new crisis that needed solving.
Yeah. Or to go on interesting missions like exploring the... Oh, there was the collapse of a star with the scientist who was very acerbic, was a very rabid baseball fan. Geordi's nanites.
Yeah.
Spill into the Enterprise and interfere. And so there's that whole, well, they weren't exploring a planet. They weren't doing a rescue mission. They were actually doing science.
Yes. And in fact, I always thought those were the better episodes. I know that TV shows, usually to save money, they'll do a bottle show where everything takes place on the standard sets. So they don't have to build any new sets. They don't need any new costumes or anything. But I always find they're the most dramatically interesting when we're confined, we're trapped in a single place, and everything, all the action takes place in a single location.
Hmm. Oh, okay, let me niggle with you. In a science fiction show where there had to be, you know, computer generated effects or other effects, is that still true? I guess are sets more expensive than special effects?
I guess CGI in the long term is cheaper than physical effects, but I mean, the original Star Trek didn't have very many visual effects.
Oh yeah, they kept recycling shots time and again.
Yeah, lots of reuse of stuff to keep costs down. TNG had a few more visual effects, I think, but they were done very cheaply because it was shot on film and then edited on video. So they had some very primitive digital effects, which have subsequently been remastered to, you know, overcome the problems with that. But I don't think things change very much. I guess modern science fiction shows are much more full of CGI than we ever saw in those earlier series. So I'm just thinking of something like Doctor Who. Modern Doctor Who is a non-stop CGI fest, it seems to me.
You know, I have not seen a modern episode of Doctor Who.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, originally I would watch it on PBS here in the States, in my mom and dad's bedroom in the afternoons after school when I got done with my homework. Yeah. You know, I have been so busy and I don't know what time, and we don't have a DVR. And we don't have access to cable television. I could have gone to the library and gotten DVDs.
Yes, you could. Yes.
And I hear it's coming to Disney Plus.
Oh, is that right? I don't know.
Here in the States. Yeah. People are aghast.
I mean, to be honest, the last couple of years, you've not missed much. But I think it's going to improve someday soon.
I hope so. Anyway, we've gotten a bit far afield.
We have got a bit far afield. I'm going to feed a little bit of background information in before we go too deep on The Next Generation. The Bible that we have for Star Trek The Next Generation has Gene Roddenberry's name on the front. And, okay, he created Star Trek, no problem with that at all. Actually, though, most of the Bible for TNG was written by David Gerrold, who is best known as the creator of The Trouble with Tribbles original series episode. But he's also a very well-known and honoured science fiction writer, writer of novels and short stories, as well as TV scripts. Now, he was brought in as part of the sort of think tank that was set up by Gene Roddenberry to work out the ideas for TNG. So basically, there was Gene Roddenberry, David Gerrold, Dorothy Fontana, and Robert Justman, who was one of the producers from the original series. So they spent time talking through ideas and developing stuff and then writing it up in the Bible. And David Gerrold did most of the writing for what we see in the Bible there. Now, here's an interesting thing. One of the distinguishing features of TNG is the idea of the away team. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that, well, we shouldn't send the captain down on a mission because the captain's a very valuable person. Let's keep the captain safe on the ship and we'll send an away team on the mission. Now, that idea was first put forward. I've got a book here. David Gerrold's book, The World of Star Trek, which was published in 1973. It's a brilliant book. It's a colossal analysis of Star Trek. The final section in particular is called The Unfulfilled Potential, and he analyses everything that works and doesn't work about Star Trek. It's a very good book, or that section is very good. Now, he says, page 240, criticising the original series, he says, the basic format of the show was Kirk in danger. This meant that Kirk, and whoever he worked best with, had to solve a problem. If the format had been a dramatic one, Kirk makes a decision, the stories could have focused on any individual crew member. Kirk wouldn't have had to place himself in dangerous situations. The danger could have been to someone else, but still Kirk's responsibility. This is the most deadly of all the criticisms that have ever been levelled against Star Trek. A captain, whether he be the captain of a starship or an aircraft carrier, simply does not place himself in danger, ever. I'm still looking for the bit about the away team.
You can see it leading up to that. Let me talk Absolutely. While you're skimming. Some of the greatest episodes of the original series, I think, are Captain Kirk being lost to the Enterprise. There's a time where he's phasing in and out of space around the Enterprise in a spaceship. There's the time where he goes down to the planet, loses his memory, and becomes Kirok, kind of a Native American, Native Indian tribe. Yeah, we're always losing our captain. And you're right, in a standard military operation, or even there's really no analog aside from a military operation, the captain is to be protected because he's the one with the wisdom, the insight, the strategy. You send other people out to do those things.
Absolutely.
And I'm reminded of the Counselor Troi episode where she is taking the bridge command test and she has to send Geordi into a plasma conduit to save the ship. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, nothing is more important than saving the ship. And that's the decision the captain has to make. The captain does not go into the plasma conduit. He sends somebody else.
Of course he does. Yes, that's right. So here's the bit that David Gerrold is building up to. He says, there is a solution for Star Trek, but it involves a major change in the show's format. So remember, this was written in 1973. Star Trek's been off the air for 4 years. There are no movies yet. He says, in addition to all the other crew members of the Enterprise, there should be a contact team, a specially trained crew of men and women whose sole purpose was to deal with alien cultures and civilizations. Kirk and Spock would stay on the bridge, as their jobs should require them to do, and monitor the duties of the team. Kirk would make his decisions by remote control after being carefully advised by his medical, science, and engineering officers. The contact team would risk their lives, but that would be part of their jobs. So he figured out this solution, as I say, 4 years after Star Trek had gone off the air. A few years later, in 1980, he writes a Star Trek novel called The Galactic Whirlpool. And on page 40 of David Gerrold's Star Trek novel, we have, James T. Kirk had a reputation for rushing in, and one day that weakness would probably kill him. But he reminded himself as he headed for the transporter room, I won't send any crew member anywhere I won't go myself. That was his usual excuse for actively involving himself at the forefront of every new situation, sometimes even preempting the duties of the contact team.
Oh.
And if you read the entire novel, and it's pretty good for a Star Trek novel, you see that the contact team is absolutely central, and he keeps referring to them. And so he does actually have Captain Kirk put his life in danger, but there is also this contact team. So that was in 1980, and then 1987, we get to the Bible for The Next Generation, And what do we have in there? Well, not a contact team, but we have the away team. So this idea that David Gerrold has been mulling over for years finally gets into the format, the official format of the show. Now, whether it works or not is another matter, because I think there are some episodes where it does work and some where it really doesn't. I just find that quite fascinating. Somebody can stew over an idea like that.
Yeah, for 15 years. One thing I think about frequently is the evolution of how we tell stories. In the original series, it was what was made famous in X-Files. It's the monster of the week.
Yes.
Right? Every week is standalone. There's no carryover from week to week. You jump forward to Next Generation. And there are things that happen that cause the show to evolve. The relationship between Data and Yar. That's something that's carried forward into further episodes.
Sure. Discovering
the Borg. And then you get to the most extreme version of that. You know, Babylon 5, Deep Space Nine, and modern shows where almost every show is part of an overarching story told across the entire season or series. And sometimes there are some just, you know, character development, plot bumping episodes that don't really factor in there. Mm. And the other thing I think about has to do with threading. Most of the original series have one thread. There's one story being told.
Yeah.
Some of them, there's two. And you jump forward to the Next Generation with the advent of the away team. There are very frequently two storylines happening and they're interconnected. There might be an interpersonal problem between two of the characters. And you mentioned how in the Next Gen, it's more of an ensemble cast than the Spock and Kirk and McCoy show with these other people sprinkled around them. I like to think about those things a lot to see how the stories vary and if that's a reflection of how culture changed and what they want, or if they're advancing it and the culture follows along, or...
Yeah, I think both, but I think there's also trends in television. So by the 1980s, certainly the mid and late 1980s, American television had very much gone over to the ensemble type of TV show, which probably started with Hill Street Blues. Mm. But then there were other shows. There was Saint Elsewhere, was very much an ensemble show from the same production company, MTM. Now, this is where my mind goes blank and I forget all the other ensemble shows that existed, but it was very much an ensemble thing. And also sitcoms became much more of an ensemble basis as well. Early sitcoms were mostly about one character or one family. But by the time we get to the 80s and 90s, you've got these sort of large casts. So I think Star Trek becoming more of an ensemble show in the 80s is trying to tap into the type of television that was popular at the time.
Well, it did it really well.
Sure. And then there's the, as you say, that has an impact on the storytelling because you now have to have an A story and a B story and possibly a C story. Mm-hmm. And although at heart they are still the same, TNG clearly went off into different types of stories.
Yeah. You know, you start off with the original series and it's kind of, it feels like the humans and the Vulcans against everybody else.
Yes.
Right. The few times you see other cultures or other species, they're either being ferried to a place or they're being explored by the Enterprise or they're being fought.
Yeah.
And then you get to Next Gen and all of a sudden, you know, the Klingons are our allies. The Romulans are our foes. Mm-hmm. And then we find out the Klingons are sometimes our allies and sometimes not. And yeah.
That then develops into a sort of a bigger universe because... as well as TNG, you get Deep Space Nine, and then you get Voyager, and then Enterprise. All of this is kind of building a bigger universe for Star Trek to exist in.
The Bibles were fascinating reads. I seriously enjoyed that. I even went and read the one for Enterprise.
Ah.
13 pages.
Wow. I wonder if that's got anything to do with, again, the changing nature of TV production. That when original Star Trek was on the air, the majority of scripts were written by freelance writers. And you would have a small producing staff who would modify scripts to sort of bring them in line with the series requirement. And in that kind of situation, it's better to have a show where each episode is totally independent once you get to the 80s and the 90s and beyond, American TV starts to become more serialized. And when you're in that situation, you can't really so much use freelance writers, because they'd need to know what happened in the previous episode and what's going to happen in the next episode, because my episode, I've got to bridge the two.
Right.
Almost impossible for freelance writers to do. So instead, what's happened in American TV is that the writer's room has developed. So you employ a team of writers who do most of the writing for the show, and they're able to keep track of entire plot lines that run for a season or more. So we see these shifts and changes in how television is made, and that then influences the type of storytelling. Or it's the other way around. The desire for a certain type of storytelling dictates the practices behind TV production. I find it all quite fascinating, but ultimately frustrating. what I really love is that Star Trek Strange New Worlds, which is based really on the original Star Trek concept, has gone back to individual episodes. And it's great. That's how Star Trek should be.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly room for, you know, larger storylines or, you know, other stories being told, but not everything has to be done that way.
That's right.
I'm thinking of, and you probably have not watched the Star Wars, the Clone Wars cartoon series, which ran for 15 years on and off.
I've seen bits of it.
Yeah, it's very episodic nature, where it would be a story told non-linearly, and the starting and ending points are known.
Yes.
It starts with the introduction of the clone army, and it ends with Revenge of the Sith. And so those two endpoints are known, but in the middle, there's a great deal of leeway, aside from knowing that all of your characters are safe.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of jeopardy.
Right. I suppose there could be jeopardy for any new characters that have been created, but not anyone who needs to be in the later stories.
Ahsoka doesn't know how lucky she was.
Quiz time. And that sound you hear is Colin, I think, rubbing his hands with glee.
Yes.
The thought of a quiz. So here we go. So what I've got here is a two-part language-based quiz. So round one consists of strange translations. Imagine you have a film, an American film, and it has to be retitled for the French market. And obviously it's given a title in French, and then we translate it back into English and we end up with something rather bizarre. So I'll give you one of these and see if you can guess what the film is.
Okay.
So a film called The Young People Who Traverse Dimensions While Wearing Sunglasses. That's the French title for a film. Do you know which film?
Young People Who Traverse Dimensions While Wearing Sunglasses.
That's it.
I have absolutely no idea on that one. My first thought was Sliders, but that's a television series, not a movie.
Yeah, I think you're getting fixated on the traversing dimensions.
Yeah.
It's The Matrix. Here's another one. I'm stretching definitions a bit. This isn't science fiction. It's more fantasy or horror. The title, this is the Chinese title for a film. He's a ghost.
He's a ghost.
I've also seen this one written as It's a Ghost.
Ghostbusters, perhaps?
Could be, couldn't it? But it's actually, no, it's got Bruce Willis in it.
Oh, The Sixth Sense.
Yes. See, he's a ghost. It's true. Spoilers.
Yeah. That's a horrible way to spoil that movie.
How about this one? This is a Chinese title for an American film. I like this one. Run, run, Cloudzilla.
Cloudzilla?
Yep.
J.J. Abrams movie.
Nope.
No? Run, Cloudzilla. I don't know.
It's Twister. You can see you see what they're getting at, can't you? But it's not right somehow. And I'll just give you these last two, and then we'll move on to round two.
Okay.
The Hungarian title for Alien, apparently, is The Eighth Passenger is Dead. And the Taiwanese title for Guardians of the Galaxy is The Unusual Interplanetary Attack Team.
Oh, that's pretty accurate.
It is, isn't it? That's pretty good. So now we go to round two. where we use actual foreign language. So I'm going to give you some titles in either French or German, because those are the only languages that I can do the accent of. So I'm going to give you the foreign language title and see if you can translate it back into the more familiar English title. So we'll start with a very, very easy one, because I'm not going to do the numbers. If I was going to convert the numbers to German, I'd have to sit and write it out, which I haven't done. So the first one is very easy. 2001, Odyssey im Weltraum. So what film do you think that is?
That would be 2001.
It would, yes.
Yes. 2001, Odyssey,
Yeah, or I could have given you the French one, which is 2001, L'Odyssée de l'Espace. Now, here's one which apparently this is the original French-Canadian title for something familiar. And the title is, this is a TV one, and the title is Patrouille du Cosmos. Patrouille du Cosmos. Do you want me to spell anything there?
No. Patois is language.
Patrouille. Patrouille.
Something of space, but...
Yeah. To help you, then, I'll give you the German title for the same thing. And see if this helps. So the German title, Raumschiff Enterprise.
Starship Enterprise.
Literally that, yes. So the TV series is...
Enterprise.
No, it's just Star Trek.
That's Star Trek, Star Trek?
That's what they call it, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Raumschiff. Raumschiff Enterprise. And the French-Canadian one, Patrouille, like Patrol of the Cosmos.
Patrol of the Cosmos.
Yeah. Okay, here's another one in German. I'm sure you're going to get this one. Krieg der Sterne.
Star Wars?
Yes. Or in French, La Guerre des Étoiles. Now, they get a bit tougher now, because some of these are a bit less literal. But what do you think this one is? This is a book, Seul sur Mars. This is French. Seul sur Mars. I've just realised I'm going to hear myself saying all these things when I edit the podcast. What was I thinking? Seul is spelt S-E-U-L. Sur Mars.
And this is a book?
It is.
Is it a book by Andy Weir?
It is.
Yeah. I can think of every other book that he's written. Artemis and Project Hail Mary.
But not his most famous one?
Yeah, the one that has been adapted even.
The. Begins with M.
The Martian.
Yeah. Of course. Seul sur Mars. So I assume that's alone on Mars.
Yeah.
What about this one in German then? Ich der letzte Mensch. So it's ich, comma. Der letzte Mensch.
Is this... I can think of a couple of ways this could go, because they're not exactly translated. They're figuratively translated.
Yeah.
This is a... You said it's a book.
And a film.
And a film.
Yeah.
With Will Smith.
Yeah.
I'm going to say iRobot.
Oh! No, the other one.
The other one. Not Omega Man.
It's the source of the Omega Man, yeah.
I Am Legend?
Yeah. Ich der letzte Mensch, which I suppose is I, the last man.
Yeah.
Or the last human. Just one more for you. And this is a book, and I know you know this book. And this uses a little bit of vocabulary from an earlier question, so that'll give you something to cling on to. Oh, no, forget the word cling on. It's got nothing to do with that. Here we go. Here we go. Here's a book. In German, Die Berechnung der Sterne. Die Berechnung der Sterne. You may remember Der Sterne appeared in the German title for Star Wars, Krieg der Sterne.
Right, so something of stars.
Yep. Die Berechnung. It's a book, it's part of a series, it's written by... And I say this knowingly, it is written by a lady author.
Is this The Calculating Stars?
Yes, that's it. The Calculating Stars.
Huh.
By Mary Robinette Cole.
Yes, I just read her latest.
Woohoo.
And it was delightful.
Okay.
And it's unusual in that every chapter starts with a beverage recipe.
How very practical.
So if you want to know how to make a Manhattan or a martini, or she even invents several drinks. And because of the characters and the setting for the book, it's very thematic.
Mm.
There are people that actually will make the drink at the top of every chapter. Hopefully we're not reading a lot of chapters a day or at work. And have that drink as they read the chapter to kind of set an ambiance to it.
Well, that'll be very popular at conventions, I can imagine.
Oh, probably.
Well, there you go. That's all our language stuff. And I've just realised if we had a universal translator, that entire quiz would have been null and void.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to past, present and future?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, I've put this one under past because all of the things in the list are from the past, but they would have to be. This is a list that I saw online called 10 Classic Sci-Fi Films You Probably Haven't Seen. Now, normally when I see a headline like that, I think, oh yeah, and I click through and I look at the list and I've seen every single one on the list, usually. But this one, I click through and much to my surprise, there were 10 sci-fi films, most of which I had not seen. So I was very pleased with that list. So it was on the website tasteofcinema.com. So I'll put a link to that on our blog. And if anyone would like to be surprised by such a list, they can click through. Do you have a past item?
I do. This past month, I did something kind of unique. I did a science fiction project. I went to Project Gutenberg. And for people who don't know, Project Gutenberg is a repository of public domain ebooks that they make themselves through a related project called Distributed Proofreaders.
Uh-huh.
And you can go to the Distributed Proofreaders website and sign up and take some tutorials and quiz to make sure you know what you're doing. And then you do manual correction of OCR'd e-texts. That's optical character recognition. So they scan it, it's translated into text, and then your job is to make sure that the automatically corrected version matches what the person actually wrote on the page. Because there are scans and bad translations and things that pop up in the wrong places and all kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. But I did 307 pages last month.
Wow, that's a lot.
And I read science fiction by Murray Leinster, E.E. Smith, Samuel Hines, Arthur Burks, George Smith, Manly Wade Wellman, and a fellow by the name of Ray Bradbury.
So which Bradbury story was it?
It was just a few pages. It was called The Irritated People. 1947, a magazine, which is where it came from.
So when you're reading these then, do you have to do a literal word-for-word comparison?
For the most part, the software is very good at recognizing characters on the page and translating them into, you know, characters in e-text.
Yeah.
But there are lots of, unfortunately for me, very familiar mistakes that it does tend to make. Mm-hmm. Like, instead of recognizing the character M, sometimes it will put R and N.
Yeah.
And I don't know, have you read Congo by Crichton?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. That is one of the challenges in that book for technology.
Oh, yes.
The B8 problem.
Yes.
But I've done work like this as a hobby for my own ebook for a number of years. And so the idea of doing it for Project Gutenberg is pretty gratifying.
Yeah, very good. Any other past items?
We talked about James White's book, All Judgment Fled.
Oh, yes, we did.
Now, James White isn't known for that book. He's known for writing a series of space hospital books.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an inexpensive purchase on the Nook about a month ago. And so I picked it up and I read the first collected story. It really breaks into three novels. The first novel is a collection of three stories, each of which was serialized over a number of years in various science fiction magazines.
Okay.
But I've read that first one, and it's quite enjoyable in many ways.
I think we should revisit Mr. White's work on
we
the
could.
Podcast. Yeah, very good. Any other past?
No.
Okay. On to the present, then. I've got a couple here, which are, they're really science-y things, but they have a very strong bearing on science fiction. One of them is, it's not the most recent episode, but it's an episode of Planetary Radio. Now, Planetary Radio is the podcast of the Planetary Society, which is a serious organisation interested in space and so on. But they have an episode a couple of weeks back called, and it sounds really boring, but it isn't, called The Geopolitics of a Successful SETI Detection. And it essentially, it's an interview with the astronomer Jason Wright. And it's just talking through what would happen if we made contact or received a signal or found a signal from an alien civilization. And not in science fictional speculation terms, but in terms of what would actually happen. What are the protocols? What are the policies at various levels? It's really quite fascinating. And then on a similar note, there's on YouTube a video called The Most Unsettling Solutions to the Fermi Paradox. Now, the Fermi Paradox is this thing that if life is common in the universe, how come we don't see any aliens? And it was a conundrum posed by Enrico Fermi, the physicist, back in the 1940s. And there's all sorts of explanations for why we don't see aliens around us. But there's an author, Stephen Webb, who's also an astronomer, who wrote the book called If the Universe is Teeming with Aliens, Where is Everybody? 75 Solutions to the Fermi Paradox and the Problem of Extraterrestrial Life. So now I've got the book and I've dipped into the book, but I found the interview quite interesting because he comes up with all sorts of explanations for why we don't see aliens all around us every day. That one is on YouTube, but it is actually an audio piece. It's got a few images overlaid, but it's an audio piece. So those two, I will put links to those on our blog so that people can have a look.
I'm surprised he didn't go with the standard answer, which is that they're following the Prime Directive.
Ah, that might be in there. I think that's in the book.
Oh, really?
He goes through all sorts of possibilities. I mean, other things are things like, why would they bother? You know, then there are technological reasons. Like, the reason we haven't been to the stars is because it's very difficult to do and we don't have the technology or the money to do it. But yeah, he goes through, as I say, in the book, 75 possible reasons. And I'm sure there are more than 75, but he's just, you know, trying to keep it simple. So those are my present items. Do you have any presents?
I mentioned reading The Spare Man by Mary Robinette Cole with its wonderful drink recipes and also wonderful characters and plot and mystery. After that, I picked up What If 2 by Randall Monroe. Now, people may recognize Randall's name from XKCD, the internet comic, but years he has answered ridiculous questions using the best science he can bring to it. And he wrote What If 1, which is the collection of questions that starts with, what would happen if you threw a baseball at the speed of light? And the answer is something bad. And then he just recently published What If 2. So I've been reading that and enjoying the science and his individual takes on them.
Very good. Any other present items?
I think I mentioned this last month, but I'm still watching Andor on Disney Plus in the Star Wars universe, and it's very good.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen that. And then finally, then, on to future items. And I just happened to notice this morning that the new Avatar movie is coming out next month, which is December 2022, for anyone who's listening to this anywhere down the line. It's called Avatar: The Way of Water. And, well, when I saw the little article about it this morning, I found myself wondering, is it going to be more convincing than the original Avatar now looks? Because when I look at the original Avatar, all the CGI just looks very, very fake to me. For me, it hasn't stood the test of time. I mean, quite apart from any storytelling and all of that, but just in terms of the visual look of it, I don't think the effects have held up very well. Presumably, because things have evolved since the original film came out, they'll be using state-of-the-art tech, but I wonder if it'll even look the same as the original Avatar. It remains to be seen. I checked the figures for the highest-grossing films of all time to see if Avatar still is the highest-grossing film of all time, and it is, which to me is probably the most remarkable thing about Avatar, because personally I don't think it's one of the greatest films of all time, and for it to be up there as one of the most money-making is quite startling. It is the highest-grossing film of all time. If you adjust for inflation, it is only the second highest grossing film of all time. Do you know what the leading film is still?
Would that be Close Encounters?
No. It's Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind?
It is still, adjusted for inflation, it is still the highest grossing film of all time. I mean, that doesn't take into account all income from a film. I think the headline figure simply comes from ticket sales in cinemas. But it's amazing that Gone with the Wind is still up there, seemingly unassailable when you account for inflation.
Yeah, it's kind of like the most watched episode on TV. Yeah. The closing episode of MASH.
Still, is that still the case?
I think that they've had to categorize it to say out of serial TV, it's the most watched episode. Right. Because I think there were some live events which have actually been more popular. But
of course, yeah. Yeah, like Super Bowls or something. Yeah.
Right.
Do you have any future items?
Only in the fantasy world, unfortunately. In January, Brandon Sanderson's Kickstarter starts fulfilling from, you know, being the most popular Kickstarter ever.
Yeah.
Those books begin coming out in January, and I signed up for the ebook tier. So okay. I will be getting an ebook every quarter in his fantasy worlds, and I'm looking forward to it.
Very good. I wonder how long it takes him to write one.
Well, during the pandemic, he wrote, I want to say, a total of 8 novels.
Wow, that's pretty fast.
The 4 or 5 that were the secret projects, and then the 2 to 3 that actually came out during that time.
So he's up for the task then, no question. Yeah. Okay, are we done?
I think we're done.
I think we're done. So, as usual, I'll say thanks for listening. And we hope you'll join us next time. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Kusky. Our theme tune is from purpleplanet.com. And you can look for the show notes on our website, which is 101sf.blogspot.com, where you can also buy us a coffee through the tip jar. And you can also find us at Science Fiction 101 on Facebook. And finally, please follow or subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We also would appreciate the odd 5-star review, because such a thing helps our visibility on the various platforms. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.